This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, whether it's at sea level or 6,000 feet, like we're going to hear about today, there are men and women around you, maybe right next door, right down the street, around the corner, who have done incredible things for the sake of our freedom. And we don't want to forget about that. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, oftentimes inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And we're going to hear a story today from Prescott, Arizona. And I've heard, is this true, Bill Schrader, that Prescott, Arizona bills itself as everybody's hometown?
I guess so. I think so.
Well, it's about time that Hometown Heroes made it to everybody's hometown here in Prescott, Arizona, where the air is thin and clean and clear. And I guess you can see, what, 100 miles off your back porch here?
Mm-hmm.
Not a bad place to be.
No. Beautiful. Beautiful.
And you saw a lot of different things during World War II. We're going to talk about that, talk about B-24s, your position on a B-24 crew in the Pacific. But let's start before that. Growing up in Southern California, what were your ambitions growing up? I'm sure you weren't thinking, hey, I'm going to go fly a B-24 in a war that hasn't happened yet. What were you thinking? What were you expecting?
I wanted to be a dentist.
All right.
Of all things. But I just couldn't make it. I didn't have the grades to do it.
I like to ask every veteran about December 7th, 1941, because everybody seems to remember something about that day. And a lot of the folks from Southern California I've talked to have some pretty crystal clear memories. What do you remember about that day?
Well, about noontime, that was a Sunday, my folks came home with a brand new Chevrolet. They didn't know the war had started. And so that was a big thing, a brand new car in our family. So that's what I remember, of course. And that same car, as a 17-year-old, I totaled it.
Oh, no.
And I had to buy my mother a new car. And there was no new cars then. So what I had to do then is, you know, shop the market and look for one. But a 1941 Chevrolet in 1943 was $1,400 and some dollars. The brand new Chevrolet was $840. That's how fast they jumped up.
And that's how the war impacted everything in America at that time. When you heard that news, I know you were just a very young man. What were you?
I was 14, 15? Well, at that time I was 13 and a half, 14, I forget.
Yeah. So I'm sure that you have no idea that this is going to affect you at some point.
Not really, no.
Was it still a jolt, though, to hear that your country, even though it's way out there in the Pacific, that America had been attacked?
I think it was a very serious thing, even for teenagers, because, you know, you didn't know what was going to happen. That was the thing.
Sure. And I've heard stories from folks who lived in the L.A. area, and you were in West L.A., about blackouts at night, having to turn out all the lights.
We had those, yes.
I've heard about, you know, fears of the Japanese attacking the California coast.
There was a submarine off the coast of Santa Barbara.
Right. So did that make you a little nervous?
I don't even know if I thought about it that much.
From the folks I've talked to, it sure sounds like it did kind of change the way of life for a while there, though.
Well, you had to blacken everything. Blackouts were on, so that happened immediately, yeah.
When did you start to get the idea, as this war continued on, that you might have to become part of it?
Probably when guys were going in the service so fast. Everybody that was graduating was going in the service, or that could go.
What high school did you go to?
University High School, Los Angeles.
Uh-huh. So you were thinking, I've got to do something here before Uncle Sam drafts me. I'm going to choose my own path, or what?
Basically, no question about that. I saw all the newsreels, saw the guys on the ground getting just murdered. So I wanted to go in the Air Corps, because at that time it was the Air Corps. It wasn't the Air Force.
Right. And a lot of those planes were being manufactured there in Southern California.
Right, right. B-24s were manufactured down in San Diego.
And just about every Army Air Corps veteran that I've spoken to, whether he was a navigator, bombardier, gunner, pilot, whatever, they all say they went in thinking, I'm going to be a pilot. Was that your ambition?
That is exactly mine. I wanted to be a cadet. I signed up in August of 43, but I wasn't 18 yet, so I couldn't go until I was 18.
How'd your folks feel about you doing that?
Well, my folks, my dad went off to do war work. My mother said no. That was it, but she had no choice.
You know, and when you say that, my dad went off to do war work for you, that's a matter-of-fact statement. I think for a lot of people today, they say, well, what does that mean? I mean, they don't have a concept of how all-encompassing this war was at the time. What was he doing, and where did he have to go?
He was an electrician building. Well, you know, I truthfully don't know what he was building. He tried to get in the shipyards, but for some reason he went out of state.
Well, and it just goes to show you, this affected everybody, and everybody had a piece of it. So you decide the Air Corps, you wanted to be a pilot. Was there a particular plane that you were thinking, oh, if I can ever get in the
cockpit of that?
I
wanted to be a P-51 pilot, naturally. A fighter pilot.
Just heard that engine once and it sold you, huh?
Hell yeah.
But obviously, there were other plans for you. So how did that course change for you from being a pilot to what you ended up doing?
Well, when we went to basic training, most of us were all washed out because they didn't need pilots anymore because I was young at 18, so there was no place for pilots and navigators. So I said, well, I still want to fly, so what can I do now? They said, do you want to be a gunner? I said, sure. So I became a gunner.
Had you been much of a marksman before? Had you had much experience?
Never.
So how did they whip you into shape and teach you how to fire a gun from a speeding bomber?
Just lots of training.
What did that training consist of? What kinds of things did you guys do?
Well, you learn how to take a 50 caliber machine gun apart, put it together, and then they would fly you in B-24s, air to ground and air to targets that they would tow.
I've talked to some of those tow pilots, and that always kind of fascinated me. I wonder what they were thinking when everybody was shooting at them.
You know, the target was about 100 feet behind them, so...
But you and I both have met people with really bad aim, haven't we?
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Did it take you a while to get the hang of it, or did you pick it up real quick?
I seemed to just flow into it, yeah.
And as far as your mindset, were you one of those guys who was eager to get over and see some action because you knew so many were already doing that, or were you just fine taking your time?
No, I wanted to get going, yeah.
When did that happen for you?
We left the States in April of 45. See, so yeah, I was late, real late.
But there were some important things that happened after you got there.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of times just the journey getting there is pretty eventful as well. Was it at all difficult for you to leave and wonder if you were going to make it back?
No, I never even thought of that.
Tell me about the crew that you were with, because I look at your wall here, and you have a picture of your crew, and each member of that crew who's no longer with us is marked with a little cross. And you're still there. You don't have a cross on your chest yet, and there's three other guys on that crew that don't. And then you even have pictures of all of you when you got together 50 years after the war. I get the feeling that you guys were a pretty tight-knit group.
We never saw each other before that. From 50 years, we didn't see each other.
But before you went into combat, how well did you know these guys? How much trust did you have with these other members of your crew?
Well, we got together in December of 44, and immediately we met each other in Lincoln, Nebraska, and we went by train to Boise, Idaho, and that's where we trained. And in April of 45, we left to go overseas.
But you got to stay with that same crew that you had trained all those months with.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Not everybody had that luxury.
No. Some of those poor guys that were in the real deep combat, they lose them. They replace people.
Well, tell me about the camaraderie that you guys had among that crew, because I've heard all different ends of the spectrums when it comes to that.
Well, we were friendly, but we certainly didn't associate with the pilot and the officers. But my buddy was my radio operator, and he was from California, too. So that's why we just chummed around together.
And what better way to prepare you from the weather you're going to face in the Pacific than to send you to Gowan Field in Boise, Idaho? Huh?
We trained all high-altitude missions and went over to the Pacific. We never flew over 15,000.
Such is the nature of the uncertainty of war.
Huh? Well, that's for sure. And how do they know where you're going to go? You know, when and why. And so they send you where they got to send you.
Was it a bit of an adventure for a teenager?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yes. Yeah, because we flew and we landed on about five islands to refuel. And we finally wound up in New Guinea, of all places. And then from New Guinea, we went to the Philippines.
Yeah, it's a long way to get where you were going. Yeah. You talk about those five islands.
Well, there's a little map of when we took off from Hawaii, and we went over and dropped our plane, I think in Spiak, I can't remember anymore. And then from there, they took us for more training in New Guinea.
Were you excited at the chance to fly your first mission? Were you shaking in your boots? How would you describe the way you felt before that first assignment?
I won't say I was shaking my boots, and I don't know, it's just something that you did. It was coming. And maybe if we saw a fighter plane coming at us, it might change my mind. But I didn't see that. Thank goodness.
I would imagine that would be the situation where the responsibility rests on you. If a fighter plane's coming right at you head on, you're the nose gunner, right? That's your job.
I was
the
nose gunner, yeah. Well, if he's coming from the north direction.
Tell us about that. What does it feel like to be in the nose of a B-24? In a combat situation, what do you see in front of you, and what is that experience like? Because you see everything before anybody else does,
right.
I think.
I was leading my crew.
What were you guys there to do? What kinds of targets did you have? What would a typical mission for you consist of?
Well, because of the lateness that we were there, we saw no air-to-air combat. Most of ours was ground strafing.
You guys were doing the strafing, you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Did you have anti-aircraft fire from the ground?
No. Again, it was late. So we were all packed up, ready to move the day they dropped the atomic bomb. Mm-hmm. And that changed the whole thing. Now we're going to go home. We're not going to go. We were all scheduled to go to Okinawa to hit Japan proper.
Right. So the missions that you got in, you flew eight missions there at the end
eight
of the war.
That's all.
And this was 5th Bomb Group?
The 23rd Squadron of the 5th Bomb Group of the 13th Air Force.
Right. So you guys had a nickname, I believe, in that bomb group.
Jungle Bomber. No.
Jungle Air Force?
No.
Barons?
Bomber Barons.
Well, the time that you were over there, from April of 45 till the end of the war, so that's a good 4 months there. What was life like? I mean, what kinds of things did you spend your time doing?
Well, my radio operator and I, when you weren't flying, you had nothing to do, really. Maybe a little ground school, but very little. We would do anything, hike around the island. We bought a motorcycle together, of which we took one ride on. We hit the front wheel brakes and skidded out, and I said, we took the motorcycle right back and said, no.
Lesson learned. Huh?
Yes, real quick.
I'm sure a lot of people listening have no idea what one of these bombing missions would be like, how long it would take, what the conditions are, the kinds of things that you see. Can you give us a little taste of that, a little perspective?
Well, it was rather boring because they were 14-hour flights.
And 14 hours. People are not used to flying 14. That alone.
I mean, in those days, though.
Well, even today, I mean, you put someone on a 14-hour flight, I mean, unless they're going halfway around the world, they don't know what that feels like. And that alone is a test of your willpower and concentration, I would think. That sounds pretty grueling.
No, you didn't know what to do while you were flying. We played a lot of dice with the crew. But, no, it was nothing to do. You just maybe catnap along the way.
And what starts to happen on your B-24 when you guys get within range of the bombing target?
The pilot tells you to get in your turrets and we'll keep looking out for everything, so that's what we did. Our final mission was to sight shipping, that the Japanese ships were flying white flags, and that's what we were looking out for constantly, is any ship that was Japanese, were they flying a white flag? And if they weren't, we were supposed to report it to pilot. They were supposed to report it.
So it wasn't that you guys were going to bomb someone if they weren't.
Not on that day.
Really surveillance.
Yeah, no, that wasn't our job. Mm-hmm. Just to spot them. Most of that flight was down the Chinese coast.
Did you guys fly all your missions with the same aircraft?
Whatever was available that day. No, it wasn't like the other guys, you know, that had their own ship all the time. No.
What was that like? Did you ever think, I don't know about this one that we've got today. I don't know if we want to fly in this one.
No, we didn't know about the other because we were too new.
Well, when you get somewhere and you're the new guys, I'm sure there's got to be some kind of initiation or
no
welcome to the club kind of thing. I mean, no. Did anyone show you the ropes?
No, you're on your own because we didn't fly formation like the poor guys did in England or the guys that flew into Japan proper.
Well, that's a big distinction because most bomber pilots and crew members that have been on this show, of course, have told us about it, and that was one of their big complaints. They had to stay in formation. They had to deal with the flak if it was coming. So what made your guys' situation different, and how was it different?
The end of the war. Like, no flak. They had flak. We didn't.
So you would go out by yourself or with other pilots?
We'd go out by ourselves.
You're the only plane on your mission.
We were scheduled to go to an island and take out an airfield or something like that. That's all.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, by the time we got there, those airfields were pretty much clear of, you know, armament to shoot at us.
So it sounds like a big vacation for you.
Actually, it was a fun thing for kids, teenagers.
And you never got yourself in any trouble over there?
No. On an island with nothing there? We were the Jungle Air Force, and that's what we were in.
Where were you flying from? Where was your base?
New Guinea, and then when we were in the Philippines, the island of Samar.
I'm sure you saw a few things that you hadn't seen in West L.A.
That's for sure.
You had your own monkey?
I bought a monkey while I was over there.
Well, we've got to hear how that turned out, but we need to take a break. Bill Schrader of Prescott, Arizona is our guest today. Before we're done, we'll also hear from his daughter, who has made a huge difference in the lives of World War II veterans in Arizona through the Honor Flight program. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you are listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 88-year-old Bill Schrader of Prescott, Arizona, originally from Los Angeles, California. In a while, we'll hear from his daughter, Susan Howe, founder of Honor Flight Arizona. When we left off, Bill mentioned that while he was in the Pacific as a nose gunner on B-24s during World War II, he bought a monkey. Bill, we've got to hear the rest of that story.
My armor gunner, mm-hmm. He was a camera nut, and he took pictures of everything we did when we were in the air, and he would leave the film rolls on top of his mosquito net. We'd leave the monkey tied up to the bedpost, and off we'd go for 14 hours. When we came back, the monkey had taken every film and pulled it all out.
Well, the monkey was a camera nut, too, apparently.
But it was so sad because all those good films were destroyed.
Somewhere there were some outstanding pictures from the end of World War II that never saw the light of day, thanks to that monkey.
And then when I brought the monkey back home, we had to take and get it inoculated over there when we came back home to the States.
Wait a second. You brought a monkey home to the States?
Yes.
Yeah. I've talked to a lot of guys who had monkeys and crazy pets in the war, but no one who ever brought it home to the States.
I bought it home, but that darn monkey hated women. And when we were on a base in Sacramento, after we turned over the plane, we were getting ready to go home, the monkey would chase women. It hated white women. Just chase them all over. But when I bought it home, my mother, who loved animals, she thought she could train it, but you cannot train a monkey from doing whatever it wants to do. And this monkey destroyed everything in sight. It would poop all over the walls. It's awful.
Did the monkey have a name?
Mary. What else would you call a monkey?
Well, I could think of a few that, you know. Wow.
Well, I don't want to tell you what my armor called it.
Might not be fit to air on
No,
the radio.
No. He was so mad.
You know, I always say that on this show we're educated, and we certainly have been today, about the habits of monkeys from, you found that on Samar? Is that where you got it?
Yeah, Samar, right.
Uh-huh, all right.
Yeah.
What ultimately became of that primate?
Well, it destroyed the power on one block by going up on the telephone pole. How it did it without getting electrocuted, I'll never know.
Are you sure this monkey wasn't named Curious George? Because it sounds kind of familiar.
But it was just destroying too much. And my mother thought she was going to train it, but she couldn't. So I finally gave it to some pet shop because they wouldn't buy it. So I gave it to somebody just to get rid of it.
And this was in L.A.?
This was Los Angeles, right.
Who knows? Maybe we ended up seeing that monkey in the movies somewhere. You know?
I think he just became governor.
I guess here in Arizona, you can get away with saying that. You know, This is this time of year, everyone's celebrating Thanksgiving. Everyone just finished off that turkey and stuffing, and maybe is still suffering from the effects of tryptophan. But you actually experienced a Thanksgiving in the service?
When we landed in the United States, we landed a day or two before Thanksgiving, which I can't remember. But we reserved our Thanksgiving dinner by German prisoners of war in Sacramento, California.
How about that?
Yeah. They had a better life here than they did when they were in their own army.
I'm sure. I'm sure a lot of them were very thankful to be alive and be here. But that had to be a little surreal for you.
Well, it was, yeah. It was really interesting.
Did you interact with them much or you just observed?
Well, you couldn't talk to them. We didn't speak German and they didn't speak English. But they were very friendly. You know, thank goodness.
Mm-hmm. Another kind of milestone moment, I suppose, or one of those days that a lot of the veterans I've talked to seem to have some specific memory about if they were in the Pacific in August of 1945, is how they found out that the war had come to an end, that Japan had surrendered. How was it that you got that news?
Apparently our commanders told us that The war was over.
What did that mean to you, to know that this is over, that all these millions of Americans have been overseas and all those millions more back home supporting them, and now that it's finally over?
It meant we were going home rather than to Okinawa, which was a great thought. In fact, well, when I finally got back into Los Angeles, I was walking down the street to get a streetcar to go home when I went by a sign that said, "We need you." And this was the Navy Air Force looking for pilots to train. And I said, oh boy, maybe I can fly now. And I had all my records with me, so I went in there. I said, I want to fly still. And they said, well, good, let's look. So they looked at all my records. They said, good, you're in. I said, oh, great. He says, when are you ready to go? I says, well, I don't know yet. They said, well, we have a class starting Monday. This was Friday. Mm-hmm. He said, you got to be down here at a certain time. And I said, oh, no, wait a minute. That's too soon. So I didn't go back in.
So you missed the opportunity.
Yeah, to fly. But in a way, I'm thankful because too much was following that. Korea,
yeah,
Vietnam. So thank for goodness.
Yeah, you might have been flying off one of those aircraft carriers in Korea.
Right, yeah.
Most people listening have never been on a B-24. Maybe they've heard some people talking about it. Maybe they recognize its distinct profile. They've heard some of the not always flattering nicknames for it. What did you like about the B-24? What did you think were the strengths of that plane?
It could fly further than anything else other than the B-29, which was just coming in. We had a bigger bomb load. To us, it was our plane. You know, we didn't think the B-17 was so good anymore.
I've caught wind of that rivalry that exists between B-17 crew members and B-24.
Basically the 8th Air Force.
Exactly.
But I just got to tell you something. Last year, my daughter got us a ride on a B-24.
Last year in Phoenix. And when was the last time you'd been on a B-24?
1945.
All right. So nearly 70 years later, you get back in a B-24.
Right.
Did you get to sit in the same spot?
Oh, gosh, no. It was all they were working on it. In fact, we didn't think we were going to take off because it had some mechanical problems. So we came back before we took off, and they fixed it. I hate to tell you how they fixed it. But, no, and she got to see the B-24 take off and fly around Phoenix.
What did that feel like to be up in one of those Liberators all those years later?
It's a lot different than today's commercial airlines. No padding, no nothing.
Well, that was my question. So on your missions, you'd be right there in the nose of that B-24, and you've got the Bombardier down there in the nose too, right?
Yeah, right behind me. CI is still leading.
You're still in front. You still had the lead, which I don't know if that's the smartest place to be. I mean, aren't you going to get hit first if someone's shooting something at your nose?
I guess. There's the turret.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's me inside it.
That's you inside the turret. And I'll put a picture of that on hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. How cramped is that position? What does it feel like to be sitting there?
Because it's 6'2". There's no more room.
And of those 14 hours on some of those missions, how much time do you think you'd have to spend in that spot?
Probably not more than a couple hours, because it took you that long to get to where you were going.
What do you do for the rest of that time if you're only 2 hours up there in that
You get a great meal on board.
Flight attendants were nice?
They were beautiful. You get a can of peaches, a gallon of peaches, a loaf of white bread, and Spam, a tin of Spam. That was your meal for 14 hours.
For 14 hours. But when you come back?
You get some Spam in the dent. We were in the jungle, so you didn't get. The Navy had the best food. You know, they had electricity on board where they were, so.
How about interactions with the native inhabitants of the spots where you were?
Well, you talk to them, and, like, I bought my monkey from one of them.
Were they laughing when you walked away with the monkey?
I don't remember.
They knew what that monkey was made out of, I'm wondering?
Lucky they didn't eat it.
I get the sense, just looking at your wall here, and I see the patch from the 13th Air Force and from the 23rd Bomb Squadron. I see a photo of your entire squadron.
That was the day after V-Day, yeah.
Well, that seems pretty eventful. You guys all lined up around a B-24, and I didn't know a B-24 wing could sustain all that weight.
Neither did I, but we had our whole outfit on it.
So half the squadron is sitting and standing below the wings of the B-24. The rest of it is sitting and standing on the wings
on
of
the
B-24.
Wings, yeah.
That must have been kind of fun to pose for that picture.
Yeah, it was. You know, I don't remember much of it now, but yeah.
And we'll have to put that online too at hometownheroesradio.com. Anyway, I get the sense just looking at your wall and seeing those photographs, those patches, those maps of where you were, that you're proud of your service in World War II.
Oh, yes.
Is there a moral to the story or a message there that we could learn from today? Was there something different about America 70 years ago that maybe you think we should get back to?
Our country was certainly together. Everybody wanted to do something. Today, I can't say what I want to say, but things are so different. It scares me what's happening to our country.
Well, I'm pretty sure that your kids and grandkids are pretty glad that you made it back from the war.
I guess they'd have to be.
They wouldn't be here otherwise.
They wouldn't be here.
One of the other things in talking to guys who flew in the Pacific, you know, some of them, sure, they faced ground fire and they faced air-to-air combat. In your case, you were fortunate not to experience that, but some of them also say that the weather sometimes could be as big of an enemy as the Japanese. Did you ever have to fly in some questionable weather conditions?
I can't remember now if it was our last mission or the mission or two before, but one of those, whatever they call them over there.
Typhoon.
We took off in a typhoon, and as we went down the runway, we were just doing this back and forth. Then I guess I was concerned. Yes. Now that I'm thinking about it, yeah. Because we were scared because we were fully loaded bombs, and you don't want to crash with those.
No.
But we got off the ground, and once you get above it, it's fine.
But it was a little dicey there for a few
moments,
huh?
Yeah. That type of storm is their murder. That storm put big naval ships up on shore. It just picked them up and put them up there. So that was probably the scariest flight we ever had. Or although leaving before we went over there, now that I remember, gasoline was pouring all over the side of our plane across our window. And I called a pilot and I said, there's gasoline just all over this thing. We were right over the San Francisco Bay before we left. And he said, keep your eye on it. But he said, get your chutes on and open the hatch, get ready to go out. And we're looking down at the San Francisco Bay, and it was dark, and it's cold, because it's always cold up there.
Yeah.
And what it is, they overloaded our tanks too much with gas, and it was spilling out. But for about an hour, we circled, and it cleared up, so then we went on.
Yeah, and for that being your first departure there, and you're heading overseas, I could see how that would not be a great start to get off to. And that begs the question, had you ever practiced bailing out of a bomber before?
Well, you practice how to bail out, but on land. You would just do tumbling is what you were doing.
So you had never jumped out
no,
of an airplane?
No, never. No, fortunately. I didn't want to jump when I looked at that hole.
I can't blame you. You know, you're talking about taking off in that typhoon and the plane kind of swinging back and forth in that storm. In that situation, where do you go mentally? I mean, are you just saying, boy, I really trust this pilot. I know he's good. It's going to be fine. Are you saying a little prayer? I mean, what do you do in a situation like that?
You know, I can't remember, but I'm sure I said a prayer.
Well, if there's anything else that comes to mind that you think I should know about with regard to World War II specifically, let me know. I want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling me about it. And I want to ask you, too, about what your daughter's been up to the last few years, because something tells me that you might have a little pride in...
Oh, she's a sweetheart.
Tell me what she did 6 years ago with Honor Flight.
She came up to where we lived in California and got some training there and finally found out more about Honor Flights. She took on a monstrous thing and came back, and she called me up one time, and she said, you want to go back to Ohio? I said, well, yeah, what for? Well, she said, I'm going back to learn some more about Honor Flights, and you'll be my first veteran. And so we went back, and when we landed there was a storm going on in Washington, so they canceled it all. But but they took us back anyway, so it was just my daughter and myself, and we got the full trip of the monument.
What did that mean to you, to see the World War II Memorial, to see all those gold stars, and to see something that was built really by your generation,
yeah,
for your generation?
It irritated me that it took so long for World War II to be built after everybody else's. That's about all I could say, and I don't understand why.
Well, because it was you guys who had to pony up the bucks for it. I mean, it was mostly World War II veterans who came up with the nearly $200 million to build that memorial, so I guess that's what they were waiting for.
Oh.
But I guess the question is, was it worth the wait? What did you get out of that experience of being there? What kinds of things maybe came to mind while you were there?
Well, you never saw 70 and 80-year-old men all with tears in their eye. It was something. It was beautiful.
Did you lose any friends in the war?
Not in our immediate, no. High school kids, but you know, we weren't real close or friends.
Sure. When you got back from the war, you talked about the Navy opportunity you had, but that was going to be too soon. So what did you end up doing? And did you ever have an occasion to use some of the things you had picked up in the Air Corps to your advantage?
I went to college for a year and a half, and I said, this is not for me. But I also joined the California Air National Guard. Then I was my job transferred me to the Bay Area, but they didn't have an Air National Guard place nearby, so I got out. And within that year, that's when we went into that Korean thing. And so I lucked out again.
Yeah. Kind of sounds like somebody was looking out for you along the way.
Oh, heck yes. The Lord taking great care of me.
Not going to argue with that. And when we come back, we'll hear from Bill's daughter. What makes her so proud of her dad and what she's done to make a giant difference in the lives of over 1,000 World War II veterans. Hometown Heroes comes down the home stretch right after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We've heard from Bill Schrader, who served in the Pacific during World War II as a nose gunner on B-24 Liberator crews. If he didn't make it home from the war, his 4 children, 7 grandchildren, and 12 great-grandchildren wouldn't be here. And that list includes his daughter, Susan Howe, the founder of Honor Flight Arizona, part of the National Honor Flight Network dedicated to flying our World War II veterans to their memorial in Washington, D.C. at no cost to them. So, Susan, growing up, were you aware of what your dad had done during World War II?
It's kind of funny. I think with my generation, I was born 5 years after the end of the war. But I think, you know, we just grew up, you know, not really talking about war because they didn't talk about war. Mm-hmm. They were just too busy raising family and working. And I'm sure you've heard that many times, that they didn't come back and talk about the war. I think probably the only awareness was, you know, in a history class, and not really connecting that with people we knew, you know, our fathers, our mothers,
yeah,
Rosie the Riveters, those who walked around and protected neighborhoods in the Bay Area, my mother-in-law, Martha, both of them, they, that was part of what they did. They were mm-hmm. block wardens, but we didn't hear any of those stories until probably about the last, I'd say maybe 15 years.
When did you start to get interested in World War II veterans and their stories and doing something special for them? Where did that come from?
I think it came from initially having sons who went to war. And from that grew an appreciation for those who go to war. So actually living through that as the mother of sons who went to war, it really changed my view on war. Growing up in Berkeley during the Cultural Revolution, when the Vietnam War had turned ugly, according to our press, and impressed that upon people, I grew up surrounded by that, burning the flag. I didn't do it, but just, you know, what was going on in America during the 60s. To begin to see this nation turn back to patriotism and appreciation for those who've served our country began to pique my interest. I heard about Honor Flight. I saw what my dad was doing as part of that faithful generation taking care of my mom with Alzheimer's. That faithful, faithful generation through really hard things. But going back to Depression, going back to World War II, they'd known hard things. They had not been protected from hard things. And the generations following them have been protected from hard things. And I think that was another piece that drove me was, you know, these following generations have to know what difficulty is, what it looks like, what sacrifice looks like. I mean, their idea of sacrifice in today's generation is going without a Starbucks cup of coffee or a Frappuccino or, you know, just some of the things I hear, and it's like, that's no sacrifice.
That's good perspective for all of us. And I'm sure a few people are saying ouch out there right now. They're convicted themselves. So it's one thing to be aware of that perspective and to gain that new perspective yourself. But to decide to start Honor Flight Arizona, I mean, from scratch, how did you pull that off? And what have you seen over the last 6 years in taking these veterans to their memorial?
Boy, starting from scratch, first of all, I'm a nurse, and I knew nothing about, I didn't even know what a 501c3 was. In fact, somebody mentioned, I said, what's that? So anyway, I gathered some very close friends around me who have different talents and abilities, and we started as a board. We took about 15 months before we raised even $6,000 to send our first 12 veterans in November of 2009. And since then, we've done 39 trips. The impact, boy, what a different view of America. What's been really incredible is to watch as we fly to see the number of people who have something honorable to cheer about. I think what a contrast between being at a rock concert, being at a football game, basketball game, where people are cheering for, you know, good athletes, good musicians, in contrast to those who probably weren't good athletes, probably weren't great musicians. But what they did do is they served this country, which is a great country.
No question. So 39 flights of veterans. How many veterans total have you taken back there?
I think we've flown about 1,100, around that.
Wow.
And they're all World War II, by the way. A lot of other honor flight hubs across the nation, which are approximately 135 hubs, are now flying Korean and Vietnam. But the state of Arizona, because we're a huge retirement state, and many of these World War II veterans came to Arizona when they were in their 60s, have remained pretty healthy. You know, they play golf. One of them was running marathons until he broke his hip at 87. And now he only runs 10Ks.
I'm sure you've met countless, among those 1,100, some really incredible people. But I imagine one of the things that makes it hit home is guessing that, what would you think? About half of those 1,100 probably aren't here anymore?
You know, I don't know. We hear back from some family members when they say that their family member passed away. But I don't know how many of them are still alive. Our average age now is 92 when we started. Most of the younger ones were about 83, 84. And now we're well into the 90s. Our oldest vet that we took was 100 years old. And we always have a reunion lunch after the flights. And we were waiting for this gentleman to come because he had RSVP'd and he said he was coming. So he came in, sat down next to me. Now, this is the 100-year-old. And I asked him how he'd gotten to the reunion, and he said, well, I drove, of course. He was kind of irritated with me.
Why would you suggest otherwise?
Yes.
I'm sure there are so many stories that you could share, but when you think about some of the moments that you've witnessed for all these different veterans to get a taste of what it means for them to be there at their memorial, to have some of the interactions, the spontaneous interactions with people, what are some of those moments that stand out for you that remind you that what you're doing really is worthwhile?
Oh, there's several. One of them I think of was last year when we were in the Capitol Dome, where it's very echoey. And we had our three tour guides, and they were telling our veterans about all the different things in the Capitol Dome. And there were hundreds of other people in there from different groups. And all of a sudden, there was applause. And it just started, and it grew, and it grew, and it grew. And all of a sudden, our veterans realized, oh, that's for us. That was amazing, you know, to hear just that echoing applause in our Capitol Dome. Most of our World War II veterans from Arizona have not been to Washington, D.C., so for them to be inside of that Capitol Dome, which is the symbol of America, and to hear that is remarkable. So that was just one, and then an individual scene was of a World War II veteran who was at Arlington when they were playing taps at the changing of the guard. He's an old Marine who hit the beaches in Iwo Jima on the first day, and he stood there, and he was weeping, and his daughter, whose husband was killed in Vietnam, was standing up ahead of him, and he didn't want her to see him weeping. And when I talked to him a little bit afterwards, he said, every time I hear taps, it reminds me of the days, you know, from day one on Iwo Jima, when taps was played and his fellow soldiers were buried.
You shared earlier a little bit of the perspective that you gained from having your sons in the service and in harm's way overseas. I imagine putting together more than 36 honor flights from Arizona, you've probably learned some things or gained some perspective that maybe you didn't have beforehand. What have you learned about these men and women from our greatest generation? And what is it that keeps you going in this? Because I'm sure it's not easy all the time to make this happen here.
It's a lot of hours, a lot of incredible volunteers who We just walk alongside. I think one of the most surprising things that I think we're oftentimes, you know, you read a history book and it's pretty flat history. You know, it's names, dates. You know, if you were to talk to most of us after we got done with our history class when we were 16, it was like, ugh, just had to suffer through that, remember the dates and names and battles and you're done with it. I think I've realized that there's a great depth to history, and history is created by people, not by machinery, not by the name of a town. It's people who create history. And when you think of all of those involved in World War II, the history that was created during that time is remarkable. And it's not just World War II, but what happened before that? And what happened before that? What's happened since then? You know, that those people, there was a history that came before them that influenced what they thought, what they did. I've learned what a remarkable nation America is and how much we as a nation have given to other countries around this world and continue to do so. Mm-hmm. We don't stop. And when, you know, I grew up in that era when Americans were accused of being aggressors. Well, and it's time to stop that kind of thinking and say, you know, we're willing to go into countries and save lives of people. I think of putting boots on the ground in Iraq. A few of the stories I've heard from my sons of the kind of terror that reigned under Saddam Hussein. Awful stuff. Awful stuff. You know, my son sat on top of hills that had been shoveled back by, there were huge mounds of dirt out in the middle of the desert that he said were about 3 to 4 stories high. And they sat on top of those mounds, and it was their lookout. But what was underneath them was villages of people that had been buried. First of all, they were chemicalized, and then they were buried by Saddam Hussein and his men. And we had gone into that nation to, first of all, fight terrorism, but also, you know, to save a people. When my son was over there, they were helping to rebuild schoolhouses. As fast as they would put up doors and windows and buildings, the doors and windows would be stolen. This town, Prescott, Arizona, the school district sent hundreds of dollars worth of school books and supplies to my son's unit in Iraq so that the kids could go back to school. They hadn't been in school in years. And that's the kind of thing that even World War II, when you hear and read the stories, there were kids back then. They weren't going to school. Our guys came in, the Allied troops came in and said, you know, we're going to bomb the heck out of these places and we're going to put the enemy down so that people can go back to living normal lives.
Absolutely. And that's real good perspective for us to gain. I guess one more thing that comes to mind on the honor flight experience that you've had. When the veterans come back from the honor flight, when you see them at one of those reunion meetings you're talking about, is there one word of thanks or a sentiment shared with you by a veteran from one of your trips that was really particularly meaningful to you?
I think one of the early trips, we went to the Naval Academy. We had dinner with the midshipmen, you know, and of course seeing midshipmen at the Naval Academy in their uniforms and speaking face-to-face with our World War II veterans. They weren't off talking to themselves or each other. They were face-to-face, eyeball-to-eyeball with these World War II veterans, interested in the stories that they had to tell, not their own. But then the World War II veterans got to ask them, well, what are your aspirations? What do you want to do? And when we walked out of the building, one of the World War II veterans said to me, now I can die because I know this nation is in good hands.
Wow. I could see how that would stick with you. And I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the guy sitting over there. I imagine being the daughter of a World War II veteran has something to do with everything you're doing. And you talked about your sons being in the service. You've seen it, the generation above you and the generation that's come after you. What makes you proud of your dad and what he did for our country and the kind of guy he is?
Well, I think, you know, war teaches perseverance. It teaches, like you said, sitting on a plane and being bored. He couldn't get away from it, and that's the same with my sons in Iraq. They couldn't get away from what they had committed to do. And my dad, I believe in, you know, going back as well, and through the Depression too, learned perseverance, learned to do without, learned, you know, hey, sometimes life isn't soft. And I think, you know, those are the qualities that you know, that I see and have seen in him. Life isn't soft. You don't abandon something when it becomes difficult. I think the privilege that Honor Flight nationally has had is to, you know, bring about a change in attitude in America, along with other organizations like Wounded Warriors, so many of these groups that have applauded our veterans. And I think that would be the message, is Honor Flight has been a part of that national movement that said we must applaud our veterans. We must thank them. But more than that, we also need to look to their needs, care for them, and make sure that they don't suffer the same kinds of things that especially the Vietnam veterans suffered when they came back, to be spit on, to be called baby killers, to be accused of some pretty awful things, that we need to applaud them and thank them.
Amen. That's what this show is all about. And let's applaud Susan Howe and others like her around the country for the work that they're doing to honor our veterans through the Honor Flight Network. You can learn more about it at honorflight.org, and you can check out the photos I talked about in today's show on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or on hometownheroesradio.com. That's the show today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.